You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, November 9th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On program today, wrapping up the unwrapped up 2022 midterm elections, Adam Green from the PCCC will be here to help us give us a sense of what the spin's going to be. Meanwhile, Republicans underperform. Red, slight, like a little, like ripple last night.
Red rain cloud.
Senate and House still, control still in the air. Probably going to be Republicans in the House. Probably going to be Democrats in the Senate. Yeah, I don't know yet. Exit polls show inflation and abortion drove the vote. Democrats gained full control of four state governments last night. Massachusetts, Maryland, Michigan, and Minnesota.
Upper Midwest represent.
Yep. Meanwhile, ballot referendums across the country show a center-left country. Election deniers largely lose on the local level. Also, some key races, ICE rebuked. Dude, in Massachusetts, frickin' sheriff got frickin' handed it to him by some lady. DCCC chair Sean Patrick Maloney goes down in really what is a shocking defeat. New York State lost four congressional seats last night. And we'll tell you why. A lot of that has to do with Andrew Cuomo being the worst. Democrats win governorships in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. In other words, three crucial swing states. In L.A., Caruso retains a razor-thin edge over Karen Bass. Hopefully, that billionaire will go down. Meta, or Facebook, lays off 11,000 workers. Stock goes up. And Zelensky sets terms for negotiations with Russia. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is, let's let Emma Viglin have the honors. She coined this phrase. And so.
It is hump day.
It is hump
day. It's an election post-election hump day.
First off, let me just say, good job to everybody here in this office last night. Also, good job to actually showing up today.
Yeah.
I feel like I just saw you guys.
Was not 100% sure that anybody would be in the office today. And so, good job, guys.
I'd like to be staying at home in bed right now, but.
That would be ideal.
I got here rather late.
Yeah, same.
I wish I had the ability to have gone to bed last night when I got home, as opposed to like then spend another hour
scrolling.
Like honestly, at one point
I was up
till
2:30. I kept going.
At one point I was just like, why am I not just going to hop on my computer and just get on there and continue the stream?
Exactly, do the reaction.
But there were some people who left.
It's hard to disengage.
It's hard to disengage, and you know some of the people who left this office last night were inebriated. So I just wanted to make that clear too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was perfectly clear.
Yeah, that it was pretty clear to a lot of people.
We announced Kathy Hochul won the governorship like five times.
Yeah. Did we say that last night?
It's like, guys, breaking news, Kathy Hochul won.
But really interesting things, you know, I mean, Michigan was very interesting, or, you know, relative to what the country, I mean, in the, that dynamic that Weigel had told us about, like, blue states being a little bit more problematic than red states because the threat of an abortion ban was not as prominent. And then I imagine there was a certain amount of like overconfidence, although it was weird. Hochul did win. She won fairly handily. And if you contemplate how many surrogates were brought into New York, maybe it was ostensibly they're there for Hochul as opposed to the, you know, someone like Sean Patrick Maloney. But, you know, the Swazi seat, maybe I'm not so surprised, but the Kathleen Rice won big and she was not there up in New York. And in the 19th is one of those swing districts. And I don't know that that was a huge surprise. But
what you can trace it back to is Andrew Cuomo's judicial appointments and also deals that he cut with local election officials and kind of entrenching a system that worked for him and was beneficial for the kinds of Democrats that he wanted, a.k.a. centrists or even Republicans in Democrat hats. And then it's come back to bite Democrats. I mean,
yep,
it's symbolic that it comes back to both Sean Patrick Maloney and, like, just the ashen heap left by Andrew Cuomo.
Yes. There's a couple of Democrat congresspeople that I would like to have seen lose if someone's got to lose. Now, I'm not going to lie. Sean Patrick Maloney was on that list. This is a guy who both big-footed Mondaire Jones. I think we've talked about that. People also don't know if they remember that he got into the AG race, I guess maybe 6 or 8 years ago. I can't remember exactly when it was, to essentially, as a stalking horse, to deny Zephyr Teachout upstate votes, particularly in the Hudson Valley area where she was strong when she ran against Cuomo. I mean, that is exclusively why he ran. And so, you know, I don't want the Democrats to lose the House. And I don't know that it would come down to one seat. It's conceivable that it could, but I don't think so. But I will say Sean Patrick Maloney, bye-bye.
Yeah, if the Democrats were to lose the House, which it was likely that they were, I'm happy that he did not win.
Yes. So here is one of the things that was enjoyable, and we'll watch a little bit more of Fox News as we go forward. One of the things that was enjoyable was watching some of the Republicans get surprised at the and I don't know how much they believed it, although according to the reporting, it really seems like they were shocked. And
the pundit class, I think, like the Daily Wire folks, they seem to believe it.
Yep. Here is Lindsey Graham on NBC News last night.
Herschel, yeah. Election denier from that wing of the party. Yeah. Well, how are you reading these tea leaves?
If you run that far behind your governor candidate, you probably made a mistake. So, you know, General Bolduc served this country well, but, you know, Sununu won big. Bolduc, you know, wouldn't talk about what we should have done, I guess, but definitely not a Republican wave. That's for darn sure. I was in charge of Guam, so I want to take credit for that.
Congratulations.
You know, we won Guam, which I thought was big. Yeah, 1993 is last time we won Guam. I think, you know, I think we're going to be at 51, 52 when it's all said and done in the Senate.
Well, let's talk about the...
Yeah, your face really illustrates how confident you are on that.
Congrats on Guam, bro. I hope they see this.
Let's not forget the last prediction he made. Let's just go back a little bit there. How many do you say that the Republicans were going to have in the Senate?
51 or 52.
Yeah. Now, unlikely. It's conceivable, I guess, 51, but we're waiting on Arizona, Maricopa County. We're waiting on Nevada, and we're waiting on Georgia. Like one of the things we said last night, if Georgia goes to a runoff, which seems pretty likely now.
Most prognosticators are basically like all signs point to it. It's non-zero for Warnock to get 50, but it's most likely going to be a runoff.
And in the event that Warnock goes into a runoff, if I had to place a bet on there, I would bet on Warnock. You had Stacey Abrams underperforming Warnock significantly. And whenever you have two candidates running, at least a certain percentage of people are voting against the candidate. And I think there was a lot of people went out to vote against Stacey Abrams. Not tons, but some enough that they may not be as motivated to vote in this in a runoff. And I think that's going to help Warnock.
It's interesting, though, to consider how voter fatigue might be playing into this with Georgia, because this is the second election cycle in a row where they've headed to a runoff for one of the, well, last time it was both Senate candidates. And who does that favor? I'm not exactly sure.
I think one of the things that will determine who it favors is what happens in those other two races. If it is for a 51st senator for Democrats, or conceivably a 52nd, right? No, not at this point.
It can't be.
If it's for a 51st, then I think you're going to have – it's going to depress Republican turnout on some level, right? Because the Democrats already have control of the Senate.
It's just incredible how much money is going to go back into Georgia. I think they spent a combined something like $250 million in this race in particular. And now there's going to be tens of millions more spent.
Good time to own a local
television show, right?
On that money front, Ed Bermila, who was recently on the show, in 2020, Amy McGrath burned $94 million and got 38.2% of the vote. In the Kentucky Senate race in 2022, Charles Booker spent $6 million and got 38.4% of the votes, so 0.2% more.
Kind of wish all that money that went to Marcus Flowers, Marjorie Taylor Greene's Democratic opponent in her race, went elsewhere.
Yeah.
Well,
could have been better distributed.
Lauren Boebert could be...
that might have been money well spent, depending on what happens.
That would be fun.
Let's see. Congressional baseball fan, 99% reporting in Arizona right now. The only county at less than 100% is Pima, which is Tucson. Tucson tends to trend Democratic. I expect Mark Kelly and Katie Hobbs wins to hold.
That's great.
That is great, too.
And we should be hearing more from Nevada. The big outstanding ballots are from Clark and Washoe counties. That might even be almost tomorrow, too, just because it's a lot of mail-in ballots and provisionals and affidavits. So.
I mean, it seems like Kelly's going to pull it off, barring any something unforeseen in Nevada. Arizona.
Oh, yeah.
Very close in Nevada with Cortez Masto. And then if she loses... And hopefully it seems like the indicators are that she's a bit ahead in terms of the outstanding votes. But if she does lose, then we're talking once again coming down to a Georgia runoff for control of the Senate. That it's going to break every record for spending, and it's going to be incredibly important. I mean,
no doubt about it.
For judicial appointments, for the future of this country, we've seen it just in this Trump case, what can happen when you stack the judiciary with judges that are favorable to you. And if the Democrats lose the Senate, that's going to be that will be very consequential.
Yep. We will get into all of this and more with Adam Green. But there's a lot of implications. One of the things that the exit polling that struck me, exit polling showed that the two top issues were inflation and abortion. Now, I think there's a lot of reason to believe that, Jerome Powell will drive this economy into a recession. But we have had great job numbers still. Last month, the job numbers were great. In 2 years, one of those two issues is still going to be around. And I don't think it's going to be inflation. And so it's going to be interesting going to 2024. I mean, we'll have more time to talk about this. But with a 2 or 3 vote margin in the House. It's going to be a crap show. One of our sponsors today is ZBiotics. They're giving you 15% off when you use the coupon code MAJORITY. I will say this. I attempted to get some ZBiotics. I ordered it, hoping that it would come before
election night.
Yep. Because ZBiotics is a probiotic drink, and it breaks down the byproduct of alcohol, which turns out to be the thing most responsible for rough mornings you might have after drinking. Then rough afternoons, for that matter. I have a feeling this is going to take me all the way into the evening. All you got to do is you drink a bottle of ZBiotics before your first drink of alcohol. You only need one bottle. They're about yay big, the size of your thumb. And it doesn't matter whether you have one drink or multiple drinks. All you do, you drink responsibly, you pace yourself, you get a good night's sleep, and the next day you're feeling refreshed and you're able to do, if you're doing a podcast, if you're going into work, maybe you want to work out, there it is. And here's how it works. When you drink, like I say, there's this toxic byproduct of alcohol that builds up in your unprepared gut, and it causes you to feel poorly the day after drinking. And what happens is ZBiotics produces an enzyme. Apparently, it's like one that your liver uses, and it breaks down this byproduct. ZBiotics is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It's created by altering the DNA of a natural probiotic bacteria that we eat all the time. ZBiotics is not vitamins. It is not plant extracts. There are no off-the-shelf ingredients. And ZBiotics has been rigorously tested and is FDA compliant for safety. So if you're the kind of person that enjoys a drink with friends or wants to unwind at the end of the day, but tomorrow you got a full day planned and you don't want it to be inhibited in any way, ZBiotics is perfect for you. Doesn't matter whether you want your tomorrow to be a productive one or a fun one or a relaxing one, don't let a few drinks the night before ruin it. Like I say, when I was in Vegas, that was basically the key for me. I could go out. I could have a little wine with dinner. I could have some drinks with some people I hadn't seen before. I could try and, you know, talk to some lawyers. Sometimes you got to, you know, grease the wheels for that.
Right.
And the next morning, I was fine doing the show.
Yeah.
Really does work.
It helped me. I told you when I went to that Ranger game, right? And I had work the next day.
I can only imagine what you do at the Ranger game.
Jesus.
It's one of those things where I would not be surprised, particularly after what happened last night here, that you end up on the ice. Anyways, Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is coming up. So order a pack of ZBiotics so that you and those joining you around the table can indulge a little this holiday and still feel thankful you did the next day. Get 15% off your first order of ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic. Go to ZBiotics.com/majority. Use the code majority. That's the letter Z. Then the word biotics.com/majority. Coupon code majority at checkout saves you 15%. Link, as always, is in the description of the YouTube and the podcast. Another one of our sponsors today is Hold On Bags. This is great. Plastic is a huge problem in all around the world, frankly. Oceans, in our landfills. We got 100 billion plastic bags are used and then thrown away every year. And I read somewhere like that something like 40 or 50% of our plastic that exists in this planet has only been created in the past 18 years. Jeez. So we're not trending in the right direction. However, Hold On is a better way. Hold On is a company that's born from the idea that there must be a better way to go about our daily chores, one that doesn't necessarily fill the entire planet up with plastic. Trash bags and kitchen bags are necessary staples. But do they need to be 100% plastic? 100% no. Hold On trash and kitchen bags are heavy-duty, plant-based, non-toxic, and 100% home compostable, which means they break down in weeks, not decades, without filling up our landfills or polluting our oceans. And their Zip Seal kitchen bags come in sandwich or gallon bag sizes to fit all your needs. Doesn't matter if you're holding crayons or carrots or cookies or candy. Get a sense of where what happens at my house with that stuff. Look, this is important. You know, the amount of just even like with my cat poop. Like I realize, like I got to clean out the
litter box.
The litter box, and one of my cats is diabetic. I don't want to. This is not a story about, you know, woe is me. But you have no idea how much urine is generated by a diabetic cat. And I'm like, all these bags for no reason. And this is just one great use of it. It's basically like scooping it up with your hand and putting it in there in terms of the environmental impact. But you don't have to scoop it up with your hand and put...
That's good to know. Yeah.
Anyways, Hold On wants to be part of a growing movement away from single-use plastic, which is the worst kind of plastic. At every stage, production, disposal, decomposition, plastic bags are doing harm to our earth, our water, even our bodies. Hold On bags are on a mission to make daily choice something you can feel good about one bag at a time. To shop plant-based bags and replace single-use plastics all over your home, visit HoldOnBags, one word, HoldOnBags.com/majority, or enter majority at checkout. You save 20% off your order. Sustainability has never been more simple. That's HoldOn, HoldOn, Bags.com/majority, or enter majority. Receive 20% off your order. Small things can lead to lasting change if we stop and say, hold on. Lastly, one of the big issues for me online is, of course, someone just asked me if I'm using a litter box in my house.
Well, I mean, as you have to keep that under wraps, but as good liberals, now we get litter boxes everywhere if we keep the Senate.
Folks, you know that I have an interesting relationship with scammers, and whatnot. I get caught up in phishing videos all the time. On purpose, many times, but I don't have to worry about doing it by mistake. Why? Because of Aura. One of the things that I really worry about too is I don't like all my information out there because there's a lot of people who, you know, will use that information for nefarious things or just in general. I mean, it's about privacy. One of the things that Aura does is that it essentially scrubs those websites that make your personal information public. They automatically request removal of your info. And this, in addition to keeping your info private, also cuts down dramatically on robocalls. Aura protects you from scammers and hackers by scanning the dark web. That's where, you know, if hackers and criminals steal your credit card information or your ID information, they try and sell it on the dark web. So what it does is it looks for your emails and your family's emails. They look for your passwords, your social security numbers, including your kids, and it alerts you fast if they find anything in that dark web, or it gives you real time alerts on any type of suspicious credit inquiry. So if someone's trying to like take out a loan for a car or start a credit card in your name, they will give you a heads up. Or it's got a VPN that allows you to stay anonymous online by keeping your browsing history and personal information safe and encrypted. Or it protects your devices from viruses, malware, spyware, so bad guys can't break in. Or it helps you manage what your kids do on their devices so you can restrict specific apps or set screen time limits. You can even set focus time to ensure your child is doing their homework instead of binging on YouTube. Cedar Kids, I'm looking at you. Aura's password manager lets you store and access your online passwords securely and conveniently. You can try Aura for free for 14 days at aura.com/majority. That's aura.com/majority. You're going to be shocked how much of your private information Aura finds exposed online over the next 2 weeks during your free trial. That's aura.com/majority to try Aura for free for 14 days. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Adam Green. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. I want to welcome back to the program co-founder of the PCCC, that is the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, Adam Green. Hello, Adam.
Hey, good to see you on this lovely morning.
Everybody's a little bit tired, but also like not feeling it in the way that that we could have been feeling it.
Yeah,
it's really a different world than we thought we would wake up to today. You know,
let's start with that, okay? Yeah. Because at 6 p.m. last night, I have collected 10 statements that are already sort of like put out there by different organizations. You had Clyburn already out there getting interviewed saying like, we've got to do a reassessment, jumping the gun a little bit. Like they're all trying. And frankly, I bet you there was a lot of reporters and analysts who already had their template written. You had Axios writing stories like The Third Way and, Carvel and, what's his face? I can't remember the other dude from, Paul Begala. Things are too radical with the Democrats and et cetera, et cetera. And they gone too far. And everybody had to toss those scripts, didn't they?
They did. And a lot of those scripts involved stabbing progressives in the back. They were ready.
Totally.
Win or lose, they want to stab progressives in the back. And the question is just, what will the terms be? And I think Third Way put out some big report that's completely moot at this point, assessing all the things that went wrong with Biden following progressives in a progressive direction. That was one of the big things I was worried about, where people basically saying, Biden, you went too far, you followed progressives too far, got to trim your sales, austerity, add in some woke politics stuff. And fortunately, a lot of those voices are mooted today. My starting point, just kind of assessing what just happened, is that democracy has another two-year lease on life, right? We have 2 years where it looks like we'll have secretaries of state who can count the votes fairly and governors who will certify the elections fairly in most places, enough to survive in 2024. And we have a willingness by voters to show up for Democrats, to keep democracy and the priorities that happen in a functioning democracy moving forward, if we earn the opportunity in 2 years, right?
Let me just stop you there too, because I want to make sure that people understand we're having two conversations. We're having like the direct implications, the sort of like the material impact of these, and then we're going to be talking about sort of like the spin, which, we're addressing, like where everybody's trying to sort of who's going to get blamed for this and how is it going to influence the direction of the Democrats over the next 2 years. But when you talk about democracy and, I've looked at the exit polling and there was, something like 30-40% of voters. That was one of their one of their biggest issues. I think that the two biggest issues were inflation and abortion, as far as I can tell. But protecting the democracy. But what does that mean? Like in practice, like when you say like what are we actually saying when we say protect our democracy?
Yeah, I don't think it's any one bill or plank. It is. I think there was a gut level sense, especially among young people who showed up and voted Democratic, that fundamental rights were being taken away, whether it's the right to vote or the right to an abortion or the right to exist on our planet. All these things are at stake. And, just looking at some of the exit polls, young people, one of the biggest variables would young people show up? They showed up, and by giant margins, they voted Democratic. Slightly older people barely voted Democratic, and then the two older age brackets voted Republican hardcore. And what that says to me is that they weren't voting for any one person. They weren't voting for Joe Biden or Joe Manchin, certainly. I'm not sure they were even voting for the Democratic Party as a brand. They were saying, we want our fundamental rights to stay intact. We want to keep saving the planet. We want Democrats to do more. And we're not stupid and enough to stay home. And I think that's one of the things about this election is that it is partly a repudiation of the chattering class that thought that voters were too stupid to recognize that their democracy and their fundamental rights were being taken away. A chattering class that said, this is just an election about gas prices, right? there was just something more swirling out there. And I think Democrats won despite the Democratic Party, not because of any kind of establishment message, really.
What I've seen from the exit polling is, I mean, the share of younger people was down a little bit relative to 2018. However, 18 to 29 was a 28-point margin in favor of Democrats. That's nuts. Like, even like 65 and over is plus 13 for Republicans. And that's fairly static. I mean, that's, but to have almost a 30-point deficit between 18 and 29, and these people, that cohort of people, they're just going to vote in bigger numbers every year, right? Like, as it just happens that, you know, the older you get, the more you start to contemplate, like, oh, the implications of who's in office actually is going to impact me and ultimately my kids and whatnot. But that's really stunning, I think. And it also, there was also indication that people were voting because they're aware of, again, like you said, outside of the candidate that they may be voting for, they understood the implications of, you know, it doesn't matter if I vote for Don Bolduc or, you know, Michael Morris, they're going to vote the same way. That's a Republican. I am empowering the Republican Party, their entire agenda, regardless of what I think personally about a given candidate. And that, I think, is also an important sort of like, I guess, idea for Democrats to have in their heads, because I feel like Republicans have always been far more conscious of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I think there's kind of an existential scream that's happening, right? Again, do we have certain fundamental rights? Do we have a planet to survive on? When there are issues like gun violence in schools, do we have a democratic process where we can do something about it as a people? And I don't think it's any one of those issues. It is just this gut level sense that we need to not let these anti-democratic forces seize control of the entire machinery and government at this moment. So, you know, I look to people like Maxwell Frost, the first Gen Z member just elected in Florida. And, you know, he's way more the future than Joe Manchin, right? I think there's, you know, whether we have 50 seats in the Senate or 51 or hopefully not 49, you know, there will be some people like the Joe Manchins, like the Mark Warners, who might be arguing for austerity, for budget cuts. Like, that is so not the mandate of this election, right? Again, if anything, it was saying, hey, Democrats, despite the fact that you took some steps in the right direction, but not enough, we're giving you the chance to go further the next 2 years. We want more action to save our democracy, our planet, our fundamental rights. You know, for those who were saying we're talking too much about abortion, like, do more to solidify these fundamental rights that we're depending on. The ballot measures showed it, you know, red states, blue states, purple states, like, Democrats won a lot, again, in spite of themselves. And again, this is a 2-year chance for Democrats to really get more done more quickly, as opposed to kind of being in this quagmire that Joe Manchin's had us in for the last couple of years.
And what's fascinating about it too is that it's way more disconnected from Joe Biden's approval rating than I feel like we've seen in the modern history of the country. Like, it just this pushing back against the red wave. There's this NBC exit poll that I saw that Democrats won with voters who, quote, somewhat disapprove of Biden's performance as president, which is, it's an exit poll, take it with a lot of grains of salt. But the fact that there's that severance, I guess, or there's that division between those two factors is quite unique and speaks to what you're saying there, Adam, about how it's more about existential issues and rights than it is about, you know, who's the charismatic figure at the top of the party.
Yeah. You know, this hits on something I've been thinking about for about a decade, which is the difference between using proxies to do analysis versus just looking at the actual issues. To give one kind of, you know, past example, I remember, you know, Sam, we talked a lot during this time, during the public option fight, when that was kind of the left flank of the Obamacare debate. There was a New York Times poll that showed that 50% of Republican voters, 70% of independents, and 80% of Democrats wanted a publicly run insurance company to compete against private insurance. That same poll showed that 20% of voters call themselves liberal. And what the third ways of the world, you know, the corporate Democrats of the world did was they said to the Democratic Party, hey, look, only 20% of the people are liberal. The public option's a liberal idea, so don't do the public option. And meanwhile, it's like, wait, do you not see the numbers right there? Like, there is a mandate for this, right? Now, thinking to the present and Joe Biden approval is a proxy for a certain direction, right? If you think about the dynamics here, there really weren't many issues where the Democratic Party writ large were running away from the direction Joe Biden was going, right? People weren't running away from the Inflation Reduction Act. They weren't running away from canceled student debt. They weren't running away from marijuana decriminalization. If anything, we had 90+% of the Democratic Party who wanted to go further on the economic side and further on the climate side that were stymied by Joe Manchin and a lot of activists and people like us who, if we only somewhat approve of Biden, it's because we weren't able to achieve the full vision, right?
Right.
So if I were asked that question, I'd probably say like, yeah, somewhat approve or somewhat disapprove, but that, I'm still going to vote hardcore Democrat. I just think that that's the reality of where we are. And just looking at disapproval really is an attempt to marginalize those that want to go further. And hopefully the pundit class recognizes that.
Let's talk about the progressive losses in this election. There, as far as I can tell, there weren't any. I mean, you could argue that, you know, Mandela Barnes is the only like progressive-ish candidate out there that has lost. I don't know if they've actually called that race yet, but I think they did. They did that. That Ron Johnson won, but hasn't been called yet. So it's still conceivable that he pulls it out. But also, not terribly favored in that instance. Like, it's not a, you know, everybody knew that was going to be a very, very, very difficult race, regardless of who was running in that race. But when we look at the losses, Sean Patrick Maloney in New York State. I mean, this is to the extent that there's any ideological lessons that can be taken from this, you look at what happened in places like, you know, minimum wage approved in D.C. We can go through these referendums. And that's what I like about like these sort of like referendums that we're starting to see. Oregon passes gun control measures. You got Maryland and Missouri legalizing weed. Now, Arkansas and North Dakota, not. But I mean, OK, Arkansas and North Dakota. But this is not, we're not talking about the center of like the political ideology. You look at what happened in Michigan. You look at South Dakota expanding Medicaid. When you leave this up to the voters, if you start to look at like the numbers here, by any definition on these key like referendums, the country is far more to the left on issues, right? Like on specific issues. You, even in Nevada, it appears referendum one is going to pass. And that one explicitly says no discrimination, not just on race and religion and sexual orientation, but also gender orientation and the way that you represent yourself in terms of gender. And that's in Nevada. And so if you look at these things, you know, broadly speaking, all of the and on a local level, you're seeing prosecutors who are supporting reform. All of the direct sort of like you're saying, non-proxy votes would argue that this is a center left country, at least.
Emma, do you agree?
I do. I'm sorry. I'm monitoring some of the races here, but yes, keep going.
But here's my question to you, I guess, Adam. How does that get communicated? Like, how do you're going out there? You're essentially like in an arena against third way, right? Like, I mean, professionally, that's more or less what your job is to make sure that that potential candidates perceive and understand that the electorate is not as you're being told by the third way types who are all funded by billionaires who ultimately want your agenda to be, you know, they want your agenda to be less distributive ultimately, and they're couching it in the terms of like being more politically effective. How do you like what's the mechanism in which you fight that?
Yeah. Well, first, I do think that we all should point out that every single Democrat up and down the ballot from school board to U.S. Senate, more progressive and more conservative, were swimming upstream and had a harder job this year because of Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, Josh Gottheimer, and the several renegade corporate Democrats that delayed the entire economic agenda from being passed as originally planned in summer of 2021 so that it would have impact on voters' lives by election day. You know, there were frontliners who were not Progressive Caucus members out there complaining that we're trying to talk about the Inflation Reduction Act, but that it hasn't been felt by people yet. And meanwhile, they are feeling gas prices, right? So again, luckily we won despite some of those dynamics, but we just need to make very clear that anybody who does care about the politics of this should not be following Josh Gottheimer, Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, and the corporate aligned business roundtable types off the cliff. We need to go more the direction of Maxwell Frost and others who are actually in, generating enthusiasm. You know, second, we can point out that, you know, Maxwell Frost overperformed Val Demings and Charlie Crist in Florida. John Fetterman outperformed what Joe Biden did in Pennsylvania. The authentic populists are the ones who are generating more enthusiasm in apples-to-apples comparison against the corporate Democrats. And it's also worth noting that even among, again, the non-traditional Katie Porter, Pramila Jayapal types, you know, Katie Porter, I was just looking to Emma, and, you know, she is ahead right now. Hopefully she'll win. Right. There are some really interesting frontliners like Jared Golden in Maine, who's kind of a quirky guy, isn't always with us on issues, but usually he's more economic populist than, you know, the party leadership wants him to be. And that's why he voted against Build Back Better, but came around for the Inflation Reduction Act when a lot of corporate giveaways were taken out. Angie Craig in Minnesota's 2nd District, she won a Trump district by 2 points in 2020. She came to a PCCC candidate training back in 2016 and has been, you know, in the loop with us for a while. We don't talk to her every day, every week, but she was one of the main people rallying frontliners to push back against Josh Gottheimer when he was trying to delay the entire bill. And I remember she said to me several months ago, I'm probably going to lose my race. Like, mm-hmm. I have a worse district and only won by 2 points, and it's a worse year for Democrats. So I'm just going to campaign on my values. And she was hardcore against big pharma and against big corporate interests, and she won by about 5 points so far. And there's some really bright spots like that. Elaine Loria, one of our government relations people, pointed out to me today that all of the people that we've been working with to ban congressional insider trading of stocks, which our polling shows is actually a very high enthusiasm issue. It's both economic populist and anti-corruption, including Abigail Spanberger, who has actually been good on this issue, even though we disagree with her on some others. All of them won. Elaine Loria, who is being great on the January 6th committee, she's been one of the lead opponents of this stock, you know, insider trading bill to prevent it. And she lost. I'm not hanging her loss on that one thing. But if you just look at a gut level, are these people communicating an economic populist of the people, anti-corruption vision on the ground? Those who are win, and those who aren't lose.
It's going to be interesting to see if there is a runoff in Georgia. I mean, hopefully, I would prefer, obviously, Warnock to get over 50 sooner rather than later. But if there is a runoff in Georgia, you know, the last runoff in Georgia, I think, was largely responsible for the momentum going into the ARC, whatever it was, the big COVID relief bill. You know, we didn't get the $2,000 checks, but we got the $1,400 checks. And they were using that in that runoff. I mean, you know, you elect Ossoff and Warnock, and I'll get you $2,000 checks. It's going to be interesting to see if Warnock, he touched on like the corporate greed aspect of the inflation that we're feeling. It's going to be interesting to see where the emphasis falls on that.
And if he goes way more negative on Warnock than, or on Walker than he was in that first debate. I know he did it when he wasn't on stage, but when you have, when it comes down to just a mano a mano kind of race situation, maybe he actually hits him on to his face on the lies about the abortion and Zen the payments and all that kind of stuff.
I suspect he's going to do that. But the real question is, how aggressive does he get in tying Walker to those issues of corporate greed and make it not just, you know, can you trust Walker, but can you trust Mitch McConnell? can you trust the Republican agenda that he subscribes to? I mean, that to me is going to be pretty telling. And so give me your sense of, like, let's assume the AP just called it for Ron Johnson, sadly. God, jeez. So frustrating. At least, I guess, on some level, you got Evers there in Wisconsin, which is really important both for 2024 and for the future of Wisconsin, broadly speaking. Okay, let's assume that we're in a situation where the Democrats retain control over the Senate. Republicans control the House by a couple of votes. What then? The legislative agenda is over, right, at that point. And, you know, I guess there's some fights to be had in the lame duck in terms of what they do with the debt ceiling, et cetera, et cetera. But what then? What does your organization do? A, obviously, you continue to recruit candidates who are progressive. But what's the theory then in terms of, like, you know, what Biden should be doing?
Yeah. Welcome to our staff meeting this morning. We'll see. You know, our through line the last 2.5 years really has been keep the trains of democracy on track. That's why this cycle, unlike any other cycle, we were all in on Secretary of State races. And I do think we need to, you know, look at the 2024 race, see is Donald Trump running or favored to win, and assess our Democratic nominee.
The answer is yes.
Well, we'll see. I mean, there might be a gut check after last night's election. I mean, there's...
Yeah. Dude, seriously? How many times have we said the Republicans are really going to take a look at themselves? Yeah. I mean, they're all pretending that they can get rid of Donald Trump. But the fact is, no, they're going to fold like a house of cards. The moment Ron DeSantis has to actually go head to head with Donald Trump, it is over.
Like, are you seeing just really quickly these think pieces this morning about how big night for DeSantis? I mean, he did win, but he was running against Charlie Crist. So, but like, huge win for DeSantis, massive losses for Trump, as if the candidates that Trump supports, the election deniers or whatever, are in any way indicative of how he'll perform when it's a Republican primary and he's the real deal on stage.
He's never been good.
It's just they're trying to will it into existence.
I mean, if we have this conversation next Wednesday, the day after he has announced, there's going to be none of this. I mean, this is like this. We are at peak DeSantis power right now. This is peak DeSantis power. Yeah. It is the day
I managed to knock this conversation off with a sentence fragment. Sorry about that. Okay. Wasn't my prime point. My prime point was, you know, we need to think seriously about 2024 and who has the best chance in 2024 of saving our democracy. Starting with winning the presidential race, but also setting the tone for the entire landscape that will motivate voters again to actually show up. So we don't lose democracy then. I think, again, we have a 2-year lease on life. That is one big consideration that is looming in the background before we get to the policy. When we get to the policy, you know, we've been very encouraging of the White House and others picking a big fight with Republicans if they take the House majority on Social Security. You know, again, it worries me a lot that gas prices were the most tangible economic thing in people's lives recently. And a lot of this good stuff that we just passed has not taken effect yet. Social Security is another tangible thing in people's lives. And similar to the Obamacare fight, Americans don't want it taken away. And Mitch McConnell and others have signaled that they don't want to be playing on that turf. But too many Republicans have taken the bait and showed their true cards that they want to cut Social Security. So I think that would be, if our goal is to, you know, pick a fight quickly that Democrats can unify on, but that is on progressive grounds and just sets up the terms of debate for the lame duck Congress and for the next 2 years, I think starting with Social Security would be a really smart move by the White House. What that also does is it has ripple effects.
How right do now, they do that? Like, how do they, do they put up a bill to say expand Social Security? Is that, I mean, how do they do that?
So I think literally, I mean, I've been thinking a lot about this. Literally, Joe Biden would start by giving a speech saying, you know, let's be clear, Social Security and Medicare cuts should be off the table. I want to hear Kevin McCarthy or Republican leadership say that today, right? Send the whole press corps back to him. Have a few other Republicans squeal and say, oh my gosh, why is Joe Biden saying this? But yeah, Joe Biden should say, if anything, we should be expanding benefits to keep up with rising costs of our seniors. And I will say that we just, this past week, we took the rare step of commissioning two different pollsters to poll people for whom inflation was their top concern. And then I asked them, here's a set of things people think should be done to deal with rising costs. Which of these do you support and oppose? Cutting Social Security benefits was like 20-1 against among inflation voters. Increasing benefits for Social Security was like 15-1. Yes, please. Taking on corporate price gouging was something like 10 or 15-1, right? So that's a really solid turf for us to be on. You know, cutting food stamps? Hell no, right? But the Joe Manchins of the world, their instinct, and he signaled this past week, is to go back to austerity. And my question is, this is going really in the weeds, but if we do not increase the debt ceiling during the lame duck while we have power, assuming we don't keep it for the next Congress, that is setting up a giant fight around next August where Republicans will have extreme leverage and try to use it to cut, whether it's food stamps or education.
Social Security. Right. Oh yeah, that's not terribly weedy. We've probably talked about that. I don't know, ad nauseum this week.
Right. So working backwards, if the question before Joe Manchin and the people like Mark Warner is, should we raise the debt ceiling $3 trillion just to get this fight out of the way, and it's just about wonky financial terms, well, Joe Manchin's going to say, I can't explain this in West Virginia. We got to get our spending under control. But if we pick a fight like tomorrow on Social Security, and it's clear that the debt ceiling fight is a proxy in a good way for the debt for the Social Security fight, then the question for Joe Manchin is, can you go home and defend the fact that you're saving Social Security? There's right. A lot of older people in West Virginia. So honestly, I think that's where we start. And that just starts an entire ripple effect and chain of events, right? If we go the wrong way on that debt ceiling conversation, we're going the wrong way on a lot of policy issues. And there's too much oxygen in the room for the Joe Manchin types. If we relieve the pressure and, you know, can pick smart fights on our terms, then Americans who currently think Republicans absurdly are better on economics start realizing, oh, we're the ones fighting for workers. So I really think it all begins with picking a smart fight, and that puts oxygen in the room for winning future fights, or at least winning the public relations battle.
I want to follow up about the debt ceiling, but let me just, I also think, and, you know, when we talk about saving democracy, one of the things that you look at, like where, what ends up eroding democracy are things like gridlock. And it seems to me that the biggest benefit of the IRA was, you know, and like you say, most of the benefits don't really phase in for a year, 2 years in some instances, and more. The biggest benefit was that there was a sense that our government was doing something. When Joe Biden relieved the debt, even though it's tied up by the Republicans in the court, there's a sense that our government is doing something. The idea that our government is not doing anything is one of the greatest contributors, I think, to the demise of democracy. If you look at like what you know, just to go back to a pre-Nazi Germany, the idea of like gridlock there was what gets people to turn away from the polls and assume that there's no point in engaging in that democracy. And that's when things start to atrophy. So I think the executive action by Biden on a host of things as a surrogate, if you will, for a Congress that is probably going to be gridlocked over the next 2 years, I think is going to be really important. But in terms of the debt ceiling, you probably have a better sense of this than many. What is the conversations around that? Because, you know, when we talk about, you know, Joe Manchin can't go back to West Virginia and say, like, I can't justify $3 trillion. Well, what if it was just like, we're just getting rid of the debt ceiling? Because that would require Joe Manchin to explain the debt ceiling anyways. You know what I mean? Like, how about this? We're not going to put a number on it. It's just going to go away because it doesn't make any sense. We've already spent the money. It's like, there's no, you know, pay your bill day, essentially, that everybody has in their household. It's just like, yeah, you get the bill, you pay it because you've already spent the money. What are the conversations going on around that?
Yeah. So don't want to get too far in the weeds, but a good starting point is to recognize that according to Senate rules, because this is where it gets boring and very maddening, you can raise the debt ceiling through reconciliation, which requires 50 votes, but you can't eliminate it through 50 votes. So,
oh, all right. Well, that answers that question.
Yeah. And then, you know, some people are being creative and saying, oh, we should raise it by the amount that Donald Trump's tax cuts cost, so like $1.5 trillion. Okay, that's a starting point. You know, again, the reason I say I don't want to get into it is because I think that we are on losing turf if we don't define it as a larger issue like Social Security. Again, like Joe Manchin should be voting on Social Security when it comes to the debt ceiling vote, not voting on some wonky procedure that we have to talk about reconciliation, right? You know, I don't know if there's any predicting that guy, but I feel he actually, I will say, in one rare good moment in 2015, you know, partnered with Elizabeth Warren to get an expand Social Security resolution voted on at 3 a.m. during one of these budget voteramas. And, you know, it was a non-binding resolution. But as an organization that had been working with a few others, many of whom you two know, to push expansion of Social Security benefits, it took us 3 years to get to 7 senators. Yeah. And because Joe Manchin and Elizabeth Warren put that resolution in and it got a vote, literally overnight, we went from 7 to 42 senators for expanding benefits. I think that's because he knows that old people back in West Virginia care about Social Security. And that's why I think we are on better ground with him and should be with everybody if we redefine that fight. That's why I encourage the White House to pick a fight early on in Social Security.
Are there any old people in Florida who might be on Social Security? I mean, I don't know. It just seems like a no-brainer that should have been at the forefront. And look, I mean, I don't pretend to know the weeds of Val Demings' kind of campaign strategy, but I feel like we did not hear enough about that, especially when you have the four Republicans who would be taking over the budget committee saying they're going to hold that hostage. It seems like a clear message, but that was not communicated well.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know if you saw, but we did a video with FDR's grandson and great-granddaughter pretty much sounding the alarms on this. And his great-granddaughter pretty much said, we all thought that Roe wouldn't be repealed, and it did. That's a warning sign for Social Security. Like, they're telling us what they're going to do. Get out there and vote, right?
I think that framing is very much underutilized, both as a political matter, but as just a point of reality. Like the idea of, like, you give them power now, this isn't where playtime is over. This is like they're going to do all of it if they get the opportunity to do it, any of it. And I think that's important. All right, so we talked a little bit about Joe Manchin. Let me just ask you one more question.
Yeah.
Kristen Sinema, if it's a 50-50 Senate, I mean, Joe Manchin has this sort of like long time sort of image that he's created for himself, this brand of like the Democrat who, you know, there's very few things that Democrats stand for that he will support, you know, on some level. But what do you think the danger of like a Kristen Sinema saying, you know, Mark Kelly has won, let's assume he has. My whole strategy of being like the Democratic maverick may not work. Maybe it's better if I'm the Republican maverick. I mean, do you think there's a possibility she decides to flip parties? I mean, we've seen this, right? We saw it with Jeffords. We saw it with Specter. It went the proper way, but for us. But do you think it's possible that she could do that?
I mean, is it possible? Sure. Is it probable? I don't think so. And especially if we win the governor's race and Senate race in Arizona, that's a signal to her about the direction her state is taking. But that is a good prompt. Here's three reasons everybody should pray or hope for us to win both Senate seats in Nevada and Arizona. If we go into the Georgia Senate runoff with 50 votes in our pocket, it achieves three things. One, Georgia voters who kind of held their nose and voted for Herschel Walker because control of the Senate was at stake might not vote or might not vote for him again, right? I talked directly to a pollster who's very involved in that race, and they said these people do not like Herschel Walker, but they're voting for larger control of the Senate reasons. So we take it off the table. If he wins, now we have 51 votes, what does that mean for Kristen Sinema? There's, you know, it's 0% chance that she switches party because why would she, right? But going a step further, you know, I hadn't really thought about it until now, but it's like, how do we get past the filibuster and, you know, all this mantra of we need two more votes, we need two more votes. Right now, the ceiling is one more vote, right? Well, she's up in 2024, and likely Ruben Gallego will be primarying her, and she's going to face a lot more pressure. So there is a bank shot scenario where we have John Fetterman there, and on select votes, we can pressure her when she's running for her, you know, political life. So let's you know, all of that breaks down if we lose either Nevada or Arizona in the Senate. So we'll see.
Let me ask you one more question. Do you think Fetterman in the Senate influences Manchin at all? I mean, because when I think about, like, you know, sort of who Manchin thinks his audience is, right? I mean, I think it's like a couple of coal barons and, you know, the guy who's going to hire his daughter, et cetera, et cetera. But in terms of, like, his voter, like, Fetterman, it seems to me, is the archetype of that type of West Virginia voter. I mean, or at least in the way he presents, and, you know, maybe it's affectation, but also from a politics standpoint. I mean, he cleaned up in a lot of different areas that are that we haven't seen Democrats perform terribly well in. And I want, like, I'm just asking, not even theorizing so much as in your experience, could a candidate who comes in next door state, like, you know, influence, like, provide some oxygen or some pivot moving for Manchin like that?
Yeah, I have been very hopeful for this exact scenario. I don't know if we all have favorite John Fetterman tweets in our head, but my favorite tweet was during the primary, right during the voting rights fight, when the filibuster was in the center of the national news and Joe Manchin was pretty much saying the people of West Virginia want me to keep the filibuster. Fetterman was campaigning in a portion of rural Pennsylvania, and he tweeted out that, you know, he was right along the West Virginia border, that the community is very much the same. And he's like, surprise, surprise, nobody in my town hall meeting asked me to support the filibuster, right? And that was a direct shot at Joe Manchin. Now, it's easier to say that on Twitter than in the middle of a Democratic caucus meeting. But one thing that I've been a little bit chagrined about is that I think that a lot of Democratic senators, even our heroes, are a little bit too polite to Joe Manchin behind the scenes. They give him way too much breathing room. You know, I think John Tester is the person who would probably have the most standing right now to do exactly what you're saying. But the Bernies, the Elizabeths, I don't get the sense that they're, you know, telling off Joe Manchin behind the scenes. John Fetterman could. I don't know if he will, but I feel like he will have the highest probability of just, you know, calling out ridiculous lies that Joe Manchin is peddling and not having the politeness that sometimes, you know, insider culture promotes. So I'm hopeful for that. We'll see.
Do you have a sense of, like, in these caucus rooms, like, if John Fetterman says something, are there like half a dozen senators who go like, I tend to believe it, as opposed to, you know, let's say Elizabeth Warren saying it, you know, like, I mean, it's hard, I think, for us to sort of imagine that, like, there's that kind of dynamic
in the Senate.
But if, like, the 6'5" guy who looks like he's, you know, just walked off a construction site goes, that guy's talking bullshit because I know the people who live in that area. Like, are there other senators who go, well, maybe he is talking bullshit?
Yeah, I think he will have unique credibility in the caucus, if that's what you're asking. And he'll have super.
Yes, that's what I was asking.
Okay. you know, he also will be the hero of this election cycle, right? He will come in to wild applause his first caucus meeting, right? Persevering through his stroke, picking up a seat. If we're at 51 votes, or if we keep the Senate, he will be a hero, and what he says will have outsized influence. He will stand for the mandate of this election more so than Joe Manchin, who did nothing this election except get in the way, right? So yeah. I think the interesting.
It's also the difference between, say, like Bernie and Warren commenting on this. They share a border, right? I mean, Pennsylvania and West Virginia.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
is that what you're saying?
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, we were up late last night, so I'm a little slow today.
Well,
yeah, I mean, there are affinity groups. There are blocks of people that listen to each other, and, you know, Warren, Bernie, you know, Jeff Merkley, Sheldon Whitehouse, several others, like, are seen as a little bit more predictable coming up on the progressive side. That's why it's valuable to have a John Tester, who himself I think is a prairie populist, and a John Fetterman, who will be even better in there. Can we just say one more thing about executive power before we wrap up?
Yes, please.
because you know the governing agenda. One thing that has gotten pretty much zero coverage is the impact of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and Josh Gottheimer, et cetera, delaying the economic agenda for a year on the use of executive power, right? I think the fact that cancel student debt happened within 2 weeks of the Inflation Reduction Act passing was not an accident. It was, right? They were waiting for his vote and didn't want to spook him.
Absolutely. I think that was absolutely true. I mean, I got to say, look, I also believe that the Biden administration screwed up back in May, essentially, of 2021 when they invited the Republicans in and then they allowed Sinema and Portman. But yes, it was quite obvious they could not start doing things that Joe Manchin would consider controversial until that vote was done.
So there's more of that. I mean, we have not maxed out executive power in the first two terms. I am very hopeful that people like Lina Khan at the FTC and Rohit Chopra at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, you know, can now get going on the super popular stuff. There are 90-10 issues. So to give one example, one issue before the FTC, did you know that Burger King workers and McDonald's workers have to sign a non-compete clause when they take their jobs?
What? So
should they want to ask for a $1 raise and say, I'm leaving McDonald's, I'm going to Burger King, they cannot, right? Because of these things. Well, that's something that would resonate on a non-ideological level with people all across the country. There's many issues like that. You know, we need to take on the airline industry. We need to take on Wall Street more, the banks, right? Rohit Chopra is taking on these junk fees, right? I write you a bad check, you cash it, you get a fee from your bank. Why? Because they can. There's all sorts of things like that that are just silly issues of corporate greed and cheating that we can take on and reclaim the mantle of economic populism so that people no longer say they trust Republicans more on the economy. So I do think that to your question, you know, 10 minutes ago, what will the collective we focus on? That has to be a part of it. I think we need to pick smart fights with Congress and, you know, like stake our flag on economic populist issues like Social Security. But there's a lot more we can do and celebrate and amplify when it comes to executive power, especially with economic populist stuff.
Adam Green, aside from the fact that sometimes it takes 10 minutes to answer my question, it was a pleasure to have you today. Honestly, it's always great to get insight into, you know, sort of like how that part of influencing politicians works. And let's hope that the Biden administration takes up Social Security, and that can become the sort of like, I guess, the fight in which sweeps up and take care. It takes the debt ceiling off off the table, as it were. Adam Green, PCCC, folks can find it at what, boldprogressives.org. Is that it?
That's correct. Thank you both.
Thanks so much, Adam.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half of the program, which is not to suggest that Adam was not fun. Adam, always a lot of fun. just a reminder, as we are on the brink of passing out, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only help this show survive and thrive, but you also get the free half, free of commercials, and you get the fun half. And I almost am on the verge of offering like a framed picture of Matt from last night.
No.
It was.
But that can be my T-shirt.
That would actually. We should do that, yeah. I think. Or maybe on a mug. The picture of Matt last night when he was sitting back. It's like,
yeah.
And that was before he woke up. Oh, God. And don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee to your chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Oh, you can actually send in a photo if you want. They'll put that on the label. You could probably get the Majority Report blend, and then they would slap that label on there. I think you got to ask them. But use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off justcoffee.coop. Emma, what's happening in the – you all right?
I just yawned. A deep, deep yawn. What's happening on ESPN?
Yeah.
Who knows? I guess Mitchell Miller, I want to talk about that tomorrow, the controversy and why the NHL just is really lagging behind other leagues when it comes to social justice and trying to root out some of the most toxic elements of its league, as well as Bradley and I will be giving our picks for this week in the NFL. I haven't even thought about ESPN, but it'll be good. Check us out, youtube.com/ESPN show for clips, and that's where OT will be up.
Yep, and Emma will not be preparing for ESPN tonight because she'll be on Left Reckoning. talking about the election with me and David tonight. So that's 8 o'clock Eastern time, Left Reckoning on YouTube.
As Emma was talking, I was thinking about, you know, I got one of those razors for my beard, you know, the shavers. And right when it gets to the end of its charge, it just starts going like, you can feel it slowing down. I feel like that's what, as soon as I'm watching you trying to describe ESPN, that's
well, like I mean, like, I was like, oh, okay, it's 1:15. Like, I'm chugging along. I feel all right. It's just this and the late night and the move that I have next week. Like, I don't know what's happening with me.
All right, so stick around for the fun Ooh. Half when the EMT folks come in to wheel Emma out. And we'll take your call. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM the show by picking up the app at majorityapp.com. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
What, who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Can we bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on!
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.